Bobbity, Jinx, go on, drop it. Welcome back to another Friday and another power panel on the Young Turks. I'm Johnny Rolla. As I briefly alluded to, Cenk is gone, but we still do have an awesome power panel. For the first time, I believe, Angelo Carasone is going to be joining us, president of Media Matters for America, to bring in a slightly different perspective, but a resource that I go to constantly. Many of our stories. It's great to go and see the analysis of the video and all that. Like, you guys are great for providing a resource to contextualize news.
And to contextualize it in a media way, which is frankly drives so much of the debate.
Yeah.
So very cool.
Yeah, and especially because it feels like, and this is just totally anecdotal from my point of view, I feel like there was this hot like period of media analysis and criticism.
Yeah.
Like a decade ago.
Yeah.
And then as people, I mean, partially thanks to Media Matters, started to wise up about Fox News and things like that, we've sort of backed off a little bit. So it's good that there are still people like Media Matters that are keeping that up and running every day.
Thank you.
So thank you for joining us. Probably familiar. I know that you're probably not gonna be able to recognize him because of the hat.
I don't have my TYT hat. This is the first ever appearance where I don't have my TYT hat.
Yeah, I offered him my Make America Great Again hat, but he wouldn't wear it.
I just, it had too many 10-foot pole marks on it. I just didn't feel comfortable.
God, yeah. Host of The Edge.
Yes, sir,
which, The Edge. I saw you had Michael Shore on recently.
We did. We have Michael Shore on regularly. He does something called The Fast 15. I do a podcast called The Edge with Mark Thompson. I say with Mark Thompson because there's so many podcasts called The Edge. It was a really lousy name to choose. But anyway, so you have to put The Edge with Mark Thompson, otherwise you'll come up with all these other, you know. So Michael comes in regularly and gives us perspectives on politics, and we talk about a lot of stuff. So it's great to have him part of the show.
And I saw also you had an author on. I haven't had much of a chance to look at his book, but it was a book about like how you drive popularity in an age of so much digital distraction.
Oh, that's a great
episode.
That looks
like a really interesting book. Yeah. So I want to listen to your talk
cool.
with him.
Thanks for mentioning it. Yeah.
Yeah, so look, it's a Friday, so it's gonna be a Friday show. We've got some incredibly serious, consequential news to cover. We're gonna try to keep it a little bit lighter, at least in the beginning, just to give you something to close out the week on. It's been a rough week. By the way, also, earlier this week, I spent a couple of days in Las Vegas with Emma of TYT Politics and a couple of other people covering the Reform and Unity Commission of the DNC. And so many of those videos, we live streamed it, but we also conducted interviews with a good portion of the commission members. Those are up on TYT Politics YouTube channel right now. You can go see those and hopefully learn a little bit about the current status of possible reforms to the DNC, which will be voted on in about 2 months or so.
In essence, are you optimistic after having gone through all that?
I mean, I'm very optimistic that we will get something. I'm not necessarily optimistic that the bar that any of us either on the panel or watching could possibly set will be reached. I don't necessarily know about that. And also, it's one thing to believe that the Reform Commission will come up with the right reforms and will advise the DNC of what they should do, but the DNC actually acting on it, that's an additional step that even if the reform members all have the best of intentions, don't necessarily have control over. So it's extremely important that people stay engaged and informed on this issue and vocal on this issue. You have to be reaching out to the Reform Commission members, they're all public, and making sure that they know what you're looking to get out of this commission member if we're gonna have any chance of getting what we think we need. But with that, why don't we jump into the news? Again, keeping it a little bit light in the beginning. We have this thing in American politics where despite the fact that politicians make decisions that will affect the lives and possibly end the lives of thousands or tens of thousands of Americans in any number of different ways, they will then take a little bit of time to go off to dinners and things like that and joke about politics, about their personality flaws, their, in some cases, their corrupt ways. And it can be funny, but it can also be revealing and a little bit depressing, and we're gonna hit all of those here. There was the Al Smith dinner, I believe this was last night, and Paul Ryan made a number of jokes. We're gonna play a few videos. First, here's one that will probably ring quite true to you.
Fact number 9, every morning, I wake up in my office and I scroll Twitter to see which tweets that I'll have to pretend that I did not see later on.
So that's a brief one for you. So that's funny. Like if Stephen Colbert had made that joke, I would think it was funny. it's a little bit less funny because he's making the joke because it's true. And he is providing a smokescreen for Donald Trump, a consequential smokescreen that has effect on policy. He does pretend not to see these things. He certainly does very little publicly to try to rein Trump in, even when he makes, when he says the worst things. Like Paul Ryan, even during the grab him by the pussy fiasco, had just the lightest bit of criticism for Donald Trump. So it's one thing for a comedian to joke about it. It's slightly different for the guy who did it yesterday and will do it tomorrow to joke about. I don't know.
Well, for me, I think that I think that's a lesson for journalists that are covering him now, that they should certainly point back to it. And that's been one of the takeaways, because your point is he is asked about these things. He does do that deflection all the time. And he really is the most appropriate counterbalance to Trump when it comes to a voice, given his role as the speaker. And the fact that he tends to not weigh in on some of the critical things is not just an abdication of responsibility, but now we know he's full of it.
Yeah.
Well, and he's not weighing in because he's got an agenda and he doesn't really care. He knows he can ride the personality, the cult of personality of Donald Trump, and as a result, see through his agenda. And he's already doing that. You saw him on the morning television shows this morning, flacking this. And again, riding the charm of, as Johnny says, making fun of himself and making fun of the process. And all of a sudden, that softens the hard edges associated with these tax cuts for the rich. And he essentially rode on that, as I say, through this propaganda machine of the morning shows, and that's what he is really trying to do. So I agree. I don't find anything charming about all this. I find it softens what is a really toxic dialogue going on.
Yeah, and like you say, he has an agenda, and when it comes to the actual laws that are passed or not passed, he can and has provided a counterbalance in some cases to some of the worst instincts of Donald Trump. But that's not the only role he should hold. I mean, he can hide if he wants to. That's his right, I guess. But he's also one of the most powerful men in the country. If there's some sort of disaster, he's not that far off the presidency himself. And so when Donald Trump is doing things like talking about possibly clamping down the First Amendment rights of media outlets or accusing the FBI of colluding with Russia to attack him. Like when he's doing those things, when he's attacking these core institutions of American democracy, well, like you're the sort of person that can speak up about that. If not Paul Ryan, who at this point?
I think a lot of these efforts, and I was watching him this morning thinking to myself, boy, this guy's really making, a play for being president, should the nation survive to the point that he could actually make a run for it. And he does it by watering all of these issues down, by not commenting or by joking, saying, I didn't see that. He was offered a transcript of the president's remarks from the New York Times. He said, I really don't read the New York Times. I mean, there was a sense of, really? You don't read? It's a major news outlet. You may consider it biased, but I think a transcript of the president, certainly there's no bias there. I guess what I'm trying to say is he's begun to soften himself, stay clear of the stuff that's really bad from Trump, right? And by doing that, I think create an image that is associated with a bigger political aspiration he has.
Well, look, he can try, but the damage that Trump is doing to the Republican brand, I mean, I know that seems comical at this point, but he is, and there is still something to be damaged there. That damage continues, and Paul Ryan may find out that when he runs for president, and he's been down this road before, he's just such a terrible candidate, but even if he wasn't, that the base he expects to be there is going to become a far worse thing after years of the undiluted effect of Donald Trump.
Just the one thing that I found really difficult about the thing last night too is I find Paul Ryan to be so unbearably smarmy that it's really hard for him to do comedy, I think, effectively because of just his tone and even the way that he just approaches everything. It almost sounds like not a joke at all. And it's just, I don't know how somebody that smarmy could do comedy.
Yeah, well, why don't we see just a little bit more. The next topic is going to be some of the tweets.
I personally have learned so much in Congress. For example, I learned that tweeting after midnight is a really bad idea. Whether you're President Trump or especially Anthony Weiner. Or Ted Cruz for that matter.
You have to remind me. I do remember. What was it that Ted Cruz did recently?
No, I didn't get the Ted Cruz.
Oh, his Twitter account liked incest porn.
Oh, that was that's right. It was a like.
It was a like.
Wow.
But likes are public, so you can see it.
Yeah. See, now again, for the most part, like, look, Anthony Weiner, obviously, like, it's a little bit easier to joke since he's actually been punished, which is rare in Washington. The Ted Cruz thing is fun. But the Donald Trump thing, like, yes, we can all joke, haha, he tweets crazy stuff late in the night. But that stuff matters. That stuff could theoretically get us into a war. Maybe you should take it a little bit more seriously. That's
yeah, and by
like
the way, they did everything but circle a mob with torches on the Weiner thing. And yet, we can now make a joke about it. Either you think it's a super serious thing involving a minor and a sexually explicit or certainly suggestive photograph that's sent to that minor. Either you think that's so important that you want to go on a jihad about it, which is what they did, and then you can't joke about it. Or you don't think it's that important and you can joke about it. But you can't have it both ways. They really did, they drove that. And especially during the election, as you know, those references to Weiner and his and really who he was and his character flaws. And I guess what I'm saying is that reference really landed cold for me. I mean, it struck me. Remember the play-by-play guy the other night, Al Michaels, had to apologize for a Harvey Weinstein joke.
That's true.
And so and yet you can get away with a joke about some guy who sent to sexually suggestive photograph to a minor? Sorry, don't buy it.
Yeah, and by the way, like the other angle of that is if you're going to imply, like, look at what Anthony Weiner did, we can't have somebody with, you know, the weird perversions that he has in a high office, but Donald Trump's cool. Let's not worry about his history of sexual harassment and sexual assault. Again, we referenced this a little bit earlier, but Paul Ryan could have come out much more strongly against, like, let alone all of the women that came forward. I mean, there were any number of different times when people could have attacked Donald Trump or held him to account for what he's done, but especially the Access Hollywood video. You can't act as if what Anthony Weiner did just strikes to the core of your morals, but you're totally fine with Donald Trump being president.
If they were ringing a bell for every double standard here, there would be a guy behind them just ringing the bell constantly. Yeah. It's
shame.
Absurd.
Shame. Anyway, let's go to the next video. I think we've got one more.
The truth is, the press absolutely misunderstands and never records the big accomplishments of the White House. Look at all the new jobs that the president has created, just among the White House staff. And when you read the papers tomorrow, everyone's going to report this thing differently. Breitbart's going to lead with, Ryan slams the president amongst liberal elites. New York Times is going to report, Ryan defends the president in a state Hillary won. And the president will tweet, 300,000 at Al Smith dinner cheer mention of my name.
Now, any part of that is, again, the sort of joke that a late night comic might make, but he's not a late night comic. He's a guy who understands that chaos in the White House has consequences when you don't staff dozens upon dozens of incredibly important government positions for months at a time. Even Homeland Security went for a long time without a director and all that. These are not just punchlines. These are consequential, and he could put pressure on Donald Trump to take it more seriously. Trump being willing to lie about basic facts that everybody understands, that has consequences. Maybe he could put pressure on Donald Trump to be a little bit more wedded to the truth.
Now I would say, all right, but it's that kind of dinner, and those jokes are sort of accepted as part of that kind of that environment. Look, those jokes are written by joke writers who all, you know, serve that speech up to him, and then he just delivers it.
Yeah.
It was delivered well, but I'm just saying it's not as though he sits there and cleverly thinks of all these lines. So in that context, I mean, I'm going to give the guy a little a wider berth. But now to John's point, and it's sort of, sorry for not having a bigger sense of humor about all of this, but we're on the brink of so many serious issues that it's very hard to look at this stuff and laugh. The gutting of the EPA, the brink of war with North Korea and beyond. I mean, the pulling out of the Iran Accord from a president who probably couldn't even tell you what's in the Iran Accord. I mean, there's so the issues are so serious, and you continue with the lack of staffing and State Department of jobs and all the rest, and on and on and on and on. We don't quite have the sense of humor about all of this stuff that Ryan is hoping that we would have, or that I certainly that we can provide on this panel today.
Yeah,
I agree.
It just has a little bit of the vibe of, like, you know, they had the people who played the violin as the Titanic was sinking. Like, yeah, you could have a stand-up comic instead of a band, but it's still kind of depressing. Anyway, I wish that he would take his position a little bit more seriously. Like, I would be much cooler and have a better sense of humor with him joking about these sorts of issues if he was aggressively out there day after day trying to protect what's left of American democracy and the function of the government. Something that he traditionally has not been particularly serious about.
And by the way, just a last thing, he could say, if he doesn't want to disagree with the president on everything, he could pick his battles. He could say, well, of course, I don't believe in that journalists in this country should be jailed for, but I think that maybe the president meant some other things. Try to soften those edges on the president's comments, mm-hmm. but go on record disagreeing with it. He doesn't even do that.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, we'll take our first break, but we got much more news for you when we come back from this. Welcome back to the Young Turks, everybody. John, Angelo, and Mark, who now is in uniform.
PYT, so, baby. I've got the hat. I'm at full strength.
The show's
I'll be honest.
Serious now.
Now I feel 100%.
Yeah. Okay, I want to read a couple of your tweets. You've been tweeted hashtag TYT Live. I'm going to read them off of this comically large iPad. First of all, a little bit of congrats in order for Gabby Morita getting married tomorrow, but I have just enough time to take a break from going crazy to watch Don Arola host the first hour. Thank you for taking time out, but you should probably take care of those last minute details for the wedding. Sandra O says, neither Wiener nor Cruz bragged about grabbing women by the pussy. Our loser in chief did. That's true, or at least they didn't get caught on video doing it. We don't know what they do in their private lives. And let's see. Sinon says, Paul Ryan is laughing because he's getting a lot of money while everything else goes up in flames, including his dignity. And it's certainly true that the Republican Party is raising a lot of money this year. Oh, and there's one other. Mark Tosiello said, doing this sort of comedy regarding Biff is a case of intense normalization of his administration. This must not happen.
Yeah.
And I agree, yes. You can have, like, that's why I think it's a little bit different when it's people on the other side as a form of sort of therapy and catharsis to joke about this. Like, it's been such a rough year, I can understand why they would want it. But when it's his supporters doing it, joking about his worst inclinations and habits, that's probably not what we need right now as a country.
It's also just, again, just to, it kind of explains why we don't maybe have the sense of humor about these things, because we feel as though we're on the brink of so many horrifying scenarios.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, actually, I was just thinking, though, so you have the normalization coming from some people on the right. So an organization like Media Matters mm-hmm. for America, you're the president of, now that you had a long span where Obama was president, now you have this year with Trump, what has had to be, what's your like standard operating procedure now? Like, how has things changed at the organization?
So I think we haven't even had to blow it all up. The core critique was the same, which is that misinformation is bad. Specifically that it isn't just that misinformation is an accident. I mean, for a while and originally and much for most of our mission, it was about that there was an intentional effort to misinform, that there was actually a concerted effort to sort of poison the mainstream media and other reporters and sort of get that out there. And at that point, it used to be just a bunch of right-wing actors, well-funded like think tanks mm-hmm. and then sort of the right-wing echo chamber. And they would bully the mainstream media into picking up their slant. That's just the most part about that's radically different now is that it's more complicated and confusing.
Yeah.
That you have sort of like Russian active measures that are participating in to some extent. I think a lot of that story gets overblown in terms of when it gets reported on, that they're not really getting to the real implications of it. But I think just to take a step back, because I think that'll explain how it all fits together, is we did a lot of early on to look at what is the fake news problem? When people talk about this, what do they really mean? And we found that there's this framework that I think helps understand the landscape today, which is most of that misinformation is coming from the same places, at least the ideas for it. It's these online communities like 4chan and 8chan, which are really functioning like virtual publications now. They're actually creating and driving a lot of what become narratives. And then you sort of have this second layer of storytellers, which are largely websites that are not designed for ideological purposes, but just to get a viral traffic here or there. And then the third piece is this distribution network. And what we found is an asymmetry that on Facebook alone, conservative-leaning, right-leaning sites, communities are 2.5 times the size of the aggregate amount of left-leaning ones.
Wow.
It's just crazy to think about, right? I mean, we indexed all of them. And that is the fundamental asymmetry alone. And if you think about how that fits into the sort of the fake news problem, that's how you can have a lot of this story go viral and have the saturation that it does, because there is this constellation of hyper-ideological communities. And then also, then if you look at that framework, it doesn't just explain, say, where you know, how sort of the fake news problem came in, but then you can start to see where bots and other forms of manipulation are a factor.
Yeah.
And I think, so for me, the mission is how do we monitor this in a way that isn't just chasing every fact, like, well, actually it's 10%, not 12%, but what are the core narratives that are coming out of these spaces? How do we think about how they're influencing the broader conversation? And then lastly, what is the kinds of data and information that we need to give to platforms to get them to, one, recognize the problem, start to put in place solutions that are not censorship driven, but rather looking at, say, the cheating and sort of these algorithmic manipulations. And that's really the biggest shift, is actually spending a lot more time on message boards than say Fox News in a way. But it matters more. I mean, if you go back, I cannot tell you how many times you can trace very specific Fox News segments or even Donald Trump tweets to a 4chan thread from 2 days ago.
Wow.
I mean, he really
that
is.
That disseminates for a couple of days and eventually hits.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And they're paying, I mean, Tucker Carlson's executive producers spend time in these communities. They actually solicit segment ideas from them, which is crazy to think about. I mean, they are, you know, it used to be the case that these right-wing places were the vanguard, but now what they're really doing is just repackaging these stories for an audience that isn't using 4chan.
Is 4chan and the Facebook community and all of these places where there's sort of a reverberation of these messages, is it more powerful than the Fox News Channel, CNN, MS, all put together?
Without a doubt. And you can even, it is reflected in every single metric that's there. I mean, in the last cycle, starting in the summertime for the first time ever, the aggregate consumption of this hyper-ideological and sort of the also fabricated stories exceeded the total consumption on social media from all of the mainstream sites combined. And that, we had to be very generous in that analysis, include places like People, just so that it wasn't so depressing that we all just wanted to quit. I mean, that's the landscape these days. They really are incredibly powerful forces. Yeah. And that's not to say they're all bad. This technology allows for an entirely different new distribution systems too, and new organizing, new outlets. So there are huge advantages, but that asymmetry is a problem. And then one last piece that I think is the most startling of all is, in the last cycle, those that identified as left of center did not post, almost one out of every two people that identified as left of center did not post a single thing related to politics or civic engagement on their social media feeds. That number is only 8% on the conservative side. And when you drill down to find, and that, which there's a testament to, when something on the left does go viral, or they do have an audience, that it shows that they're overcoming not just a distribution asymmetry, but a participation gap. And for me, you know, our mission now is as much about understanding what's happening in these communities and these landscapes and the structural pieces around it, as it is about sounding the alarm about that one stat. Because every single assumption about getting back to power, about political organizing, is based on the idea that if they just have the right message or the best digital strategy, they'll find the people. And if more and more of those people that identify as left of center are tuning out, how do you get them back in? How do you market to them or target them or pull them in if they're just disengaging? Because they just don't want to be abused because of the landscape that's
there. I would not have guessed that it was that high.
It's really high. It's a very scary and disturbing statistic.
Wow.
And I think that I see that as really a big piece of our core mission, is as much about understanding it and what's going into these communities and how they're sort of creating not just the asymmetry between the distribution platforms, but even between participation. And then what do we need to do to really start to deal with it?
Wow,
that's extraordinary.
Man, I've
got so many follow-ups. We got other stuff to do.
We'll
I know,
but later on. But yeah, I mean, the stereotype is that everybody just wants to get out, and they're talking and all that. But that is a huge gap between progressives and non-progressives. Anyway, let's jump back into the news. We're several days into this insane feud that has developed out of the military situation in Niger just a couple of weeks ago. And it's gone through multiple iterations. And the latest one that we're on is there is this concerted effort coming out of the White House to discredit the Congresswoman Frederica Wilson, because she happened to be present for a presidential phone call to the widow of a soldier slain in the field. And the willingness to play fast and loose with facts about speeches that have been given, coming not just out of Donald Trump, where we would expect it, but out of generals like John Kelly, is certainly disappointing. And so we're going to show how the most recent attack by John Kelly during his emotional speech yesterday about what it's like to be a father who's lost a soldier in combat. We're going to break down some of the mistruths that were spread during that speech. But first, in case you didn't see it, here is General John Kelly.
And a congresswoman stood up and in the long tradition of empty barrels making the most noise, stood up there and all of that, and talked about how she was instrumental in getting the funding for that building, and how she took care of her constituents because she got the money, and she just called up President Obama, and on that phone call, he gave the money, the $20 million to build the building. And she sat down, and we were stunned. Stunned that she'd done it. Even for someone that is that empty a barrel, we were stunned. But you know, none of us went to the press and criticized. None of us stood up and were appalled. We just said, okay, fine.
It's an organic, totally not planned narrative when you use the expression empty barrel like three times,
right,
in a minute long bit of a speech there. Yeah, so also saying there was the little chyron at the bottom that said, stunned that she would listen in on the call. There's this complete lack of interest in actually understanding the relationship between this congresswoman and not just the widow, but the soldier who was actually killed, and that would allow you to understand exactly why the situation played out the way it was. And we're gonna get to the substance of it. We're gonna play a little bit of the speech that shows how wrong he was there. But there's this inability in the White House to understand when you've made a little error and simply kill it just by like apologize, move on. They have to double down. And Donald Trump's need to do that draws in people like John Kelly into giving a speech like that I'm sure he had no interest in giving and was probably pushed into. But anyway, he says there that she's an empty barrel, grandstanding. Apparently, this recent situation is just an example of it, because you can go back and see other examples, like when she took credit for this FBI building. So here is the actual speech that she gave that he was alluding to.
The brand new federal building that will house the FBI has been built. And the FBI approaches my office. Congresswoman Wilson, the ribbon cutting has been scheduled in 4 short weeks. The dedication is on the government's calendar and cannot be changed. One problem, the FBI wants to name this gorgeous edifice at the same time in 4 weeks. Everyone said that's impossible. It takes at least 8 months to a year to complete the process through the House, the Senate, and to the President's office. I said, I'm a school principal. And I said, excuse my French, oh hell no, we're gonna get this done. Immediately, I went to an attack mode. I went to the Speaker. Speaker Boehner, and I said, Mr. Speaker, I need your help. The FBI needs your help, and our country needs your help, and we have no time to waste. He went into attack mode, and in 2 days, pulled it out of committee, brought it to the floor for a vote. Representative Corbell and I presented it. We all voted, and I dashed it over to the Senate and put our senators on notice. Put it on your radar, Senator Nelson and Senator Rubio, who I believe have representatives here today. They hotlined it to the Senate floor in just 2 days. And guess what? The president signed the bill into law this past Tuesday, April 7th, 2015, with a bang, bang, bang. It is a miracle, to say the least. But it speaks to the respect that our Congress has for the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the men and women who put their lives on the line every single day. And today we're providing a boost to our nation.
So it goes on like that, but what you see there is that she is talking about the process, I mean, at this dedication, of getting some additional funding. And to the extent that she's grandstanding, she's also giving credit to basically everyone else along the way.
Yeah, she's quite inclusive.
It was an anecdote about finalizing something for the building and not what General Kelly said, which is claiming she got the money to build the building and made it all about herself. You could say that she's giving a rambling anecdote, And that's what politicians do, unfortunately. But to say that this is an example of her trying to take credit for everything herself and to discredit her so that you can't believe that she represents that widow who has come out and confirmed that Trump said what he said. Trump's own people in the White House have confirmed that he said what he said, and they're attempting to muddy the waters and confuse you about the entire thing.
Well, you know, and just as a testament to the anecdote that she was giving, you know, James Comey was at that dedication as well. He was the FBI director then, and it was in his prepared remarks as well, discussing the importance of it having a name for the dedication mm-hmm. and how quickly the congresswoman was able to provide the sort of the initial boost to get that to happen. I mean, it was really a big deal for them.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't like was out of left field either. I mean, this was part of their prepared remarks. I mean, I think it just goes back to the fact that this is a reflection of, and I know this is an easy go-to, but it's also true, of what Trump's MO is as sort of this burgeoning autocratic approach, which is to cash in on other people to make them go out there and subjugate themselves. I've watched every time he's pulled Kelly on stage. He's done it multiple times. And in every event, Kelly says not a single word. He just nods, points to the president and claps, and everybody cheers and he walks away.
Yeah.
He had to give this speech just like Tillerson had to do it 3 weeks ago, and I didn't say he was a moron. I mean, every time he makes people go out there and do that.
And then eventually cast them off.
And that's exactly right. He just burns their credibility down and then sort of moves on. And I think that's a reflection of his overall approach.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, look, I wish that there hadn't been this weird tangent in the news, but I do think it's important, especially for Trump supporters, to understand that, you know, once you forget about the John Kelly and the Wilson thing, but the disrespect given routinely from Donald Trump to the Gold Star families and all that is important. I don't know that it'll actually penetrate any of his supporters, that they'll be affected by it. He has been routinely disrespectful towards the military for multiple years now at this point. But that is something. And hopefully, once this has been resolved, we can get back to the real story, which is what actually happened in Africa, how we got to that situation. Not just what actually happened that night, but why that situation developed. There was last night, I believe Rachel Maddow talked a little bit about some of the policy decisions that might have led to that, having to do with Chad and things like that. So you can do that research as well. But that is an interesting situation. The reason we have this tangent is because Donald Trump refused to go on record about what actually happened on the ground there. And it might well be, I saw this editorial and it was, don't make this situation into Trump's Benghazi. And what I actually think is this is exactly like Benghazi. Not what Benghazi became, but what it actually was, which is a military situation that ended in tragedy. And more than likely, although information is still coming in, including today, that resulted in some bad decisions, a lack of planning. In this case, it seems like probably an over-reliance on unreliable private contractors, which we talk about a lot on this show. That there's no huge conspiracy, there's just irresponsibility and poor decision making. But we didn't actually get to have that conversation because Donald Trump refused to actually go on the record and talk about what happened to try to cover for the incompetence on the ground and made the situation so much worse because he refused to be forthcoming.
Yeah, I mean, you're exactly right. In fact, during this, when this whole thing was first happening, I thought, I hope the press is going to ask about why our troops are there, what that mission is all about. Of course, that's not what happened. It ended up being a whole question of, how come you've waited so long to call the families and it turned into what we've just been talking about. But the specifics also of how Trump has tarnished and how Kelly and this administration has tarnished this congresswoman, how she was listening in on the call. When in truth, I mean, there's a sense that everybody's sitting around and she's listening on the extension, you know.
Yeah. It was the widow put it on speakerphone, which,
because she was,
sorry, she gets to do that if she
wants driving to pick up the corpse of her dead son. And the congresswoman was accompanying her. And the call came in and it was on the speakerphone. There's nothing damning about that scenario.
Yeah.
And it explains, as you say, the relationship between the congresswoman and the family and that fallen soldier.
Yeah.
But the fact that it has been politicized, to use the overused word, but it's quite appropriate. But also that it's been used to somehow tarnish this very proud family and this congresswoman is just abhorrent to me.
Yeah, yeah. And again, look, obviously this whole situation very important. But I agree. Like at some point, the real story is even outside of this one incident. It's the contextual battle that's going on in this region. And I believe today, I forget who it was, the senator talking about how it might have been Lindsey Graham talking about how the war has shifted to Africa. And it's a complicated region, multiple countries bordering Niger are dealing with situations with terrorist groups that are at least affiliated with ISIS or at least philosophically aligned to some extent with ISIS. And people need to know about that. There needs to be a conversation about the number of troops that are there, what the mission is, how do we assess if it's been successful or not? Are we simply going to leave them for years on end as we have in other areas? How many troops are actually there? Is it 100 or is it 1,000? That seems important. I think that we should probably know that. And we are still waiting for some information to come out about this particular incident. It will come out. There's an investigation ongoing, but in particular, the private contractor that sent the rescue, the helicopter, if it was their fault for leaving behind a soldier, we need to know that. And we have been long overdue for a larger conversation about the role of private military contractors in our operations. And maybe this could be one of the things that leads to that.
I'm so glad you mentioned private contractors, because just quickly, there is a big move. Eric Prince, the Blackwater head, they're the big contractors who made out like crazy on the Iraq war. He is pushing, and he did it in a New York Times editorial. He's pushing for the privatization of all of these wars, that we contract all of these different things out, that now is the time to privately contract all of these different skirmishes and war theaters out. And this is the administration to help him do it. Yeah. If ever there was a time in this country when we would hand over the keys to our military, to private contractors, it's now. So just keep your eye on that ball as this entire debate continues. Anything to do with the military, keep your eye on the private contractor part of that equation.
Yeah. Before we take our next break, there's one more story I want to talk about, another incredibly serious story. In advance of the speech at a university in Florida of the white supremacist Richard Spencer, there were concerns about possible violence. I know that well over $500,000 was spent by the university for security. Would have been great if they were able to spend that on something else, but no, they have to spend it to protect the students from the violence that could erupt from a Nazi's speech. So they did that. He had his speech, we reported on it yesterday. It seems like he didn't really get to say much. It was mostly shouted out. Sorry, buddy, that's what free speech is like. But the concerns about possible violence were not misplaced. I mean, he is, of course, an integral part of the situation that developed in Charlottesville that resulted in the murder of a protester. Heather Heyer was killed there. And so the concern was that somebody else could possibly lose their life, possibly even more, when you put out a message designed to draw these extreme lunatics to you. And it turns out that those fears were well placed. Let's bring up this picture. You're going to see three individuals. Big fans of Richard Spencer there. And turns out that they tried to murder someone after attending his speech. So they were arrested. The arrest report said a silver Jeep containing those three men pulled up to a bus stop where protesters were sitting. One of the suspects started yelling Heil Hitler, in case this story and the narrative, the arc that it's going to take wasn't obvious enough for you.
Very seldom does anything good follow yelling Heil Hitler.
Except when Jeffrey Lord got fired.
Okay.
That's a good point. But in this particular case, one of the individuals allegedly stepped out of the Jeep with a handgun. The two others egged him on to shoot them and kill them, talking about some of the protesters. And thankfully, nobody died because he doesn't know. He apparently has terrible aim. He fired at the protesters and missed, thankfully, then fled as a coward. And thankfully, they took down the license plate number of the Jeep and they were able to be found.
By the way, that's amazing because the shots had just been fired. Everybody's crazy and still they
scribbled
still
got it down
the license plate.
I don't understand how they did it, but they did it thankfully. And what's so interesting is that when you go to before the speech, it turns out that some of those individuals who tried to murder protesters against Richard Spencer there were quite vocal about what they were looking to get. And there are things that they said don't necessarily line up with their actions. Now, Tyler Tenbrick, the one who actually fired the shot, said, "It appears that the only answer left is violence and nobody wants that." Well, maybe not nobody. Seems like you want that, actually. It seems like you brought a gun to this event looking to murder someone. And then one of the other individuals who was egging him on says, "Only people who think we're the violent ones causing violence are people who watch CNN." But then you were the guy shouting to murder the protesters, so that undercuts your message there a little bit. And William Fears went on to say, "We're starting to want to intimidate back. We don't want violence, we don't want harm. But at the end of the day, we're not opposed to defending ourselves. I don't know what defending means to him, but it probably doesn't mean getting out of your Jeep and firing a weapon, a firearm, at unarmed protesters.
And I think, you know, one thing about that, I think this happened after Charlottesville, and it's certainly evidence here, is that one thing to keep in mind is one of the ways that the white supremacist, white nationalist, and ethno-nationalist movements are recruiting, and one of the reasons they're growing so quickly, is that they're actually coming from these sort of men's rights advocacy spaces online. So that's like Proud Boys and a bunch of other sort of groups like that. One is that they actually have a subarm for them that's sort of programmed they call it a private militia. The name of it is the Fraternal Order of the Alt Knights. It's like you can't even make fun of them sometimes, but they're being serious. I mean, they believe exactly that violence is the only answer, even though nobody wants it. It's one of the hallmarks of their constant refrains.
And they see themselves as the aggrieved party.
That's exactly right. And so, in a way, there's sort of this combination of this recruiting pool. And you see these white nationalists, white supremacists, and ethno nationalists actually coming and going to them, say, oh, well, this is largely the kinds of people that we could pull into our fold. And they're actually coming from what is essentially these young white men communities that are mostly, like you said, aggrieved. I mean, and as evidence of that, the leading social media accounts for white supremacy on Twitter had a 300% increase between the years of 2014 and 2016.
Wow. And
you know, that's the white genocide community is sort of how they define themselves broadly. And it is a reflection of the landscape. There's a reason why they're turning towards violence. They're actually pre-organized and predisposed to that. Much of what we saw in Charlottesville came from these communities. The fact that there was people there ready for violence, it wasn't just that there was a bunch of nasty white nationalists, they actually are training for this. Mm-hmm. That is what this fraternal order does. Yeah. And you know, just today, the Hilton in Arizona had to cancel a conference from VDARE, which is another leading white nationalist organization. This is the first year that they've ever tried to host a national conference and convening for white supremacists in sort of like a literally like a trade association kind of thing, because they are emboldened. And these are not outliers. These
and
are
worried that this would come from Donald Trump. I mean,
that's
as
right.
you said, it has been building.
Right.
But now they feel like, and you see this, by the way, all these reports come out of a person accosts someone in a convenience store or something, and they shout things like, "This is Trump's America. The world's a different place now." Trump himself said it last week. You know, we're going back to a different time. That's what we warned about, and it looks like a lot of people are very enthusiastic about it. And by the way, I mean, there's been a little bit of reporting of this attempted murder. It seems like it would be picked up a little bit more, considering the last big meeting did lead to the murder of a protester. What I find a little bit odd is that the people on both on the right, you know, people like Tommy Lauren and the classic liberals who care so much about free speech rights, when a protester is almost gunned down by people who say at least that they're on your side, you may disagree that they're on your side, but they're claiming to be aligned with you. When they try to take the lives of people who are speaking out and protesting, acting politically, why then does your concern for free speech not come up? Why are there no tweets? Why are there no blogs? Or why are there no vlogs, no final thoughts? It's weird that there's suddenly silence from you when your side is attempting to gun down people they disagree with.
We need that bell. For the double standards.
We do need
the
exactly. bell. There's a lot of double standards going around. I think that pretty much for the rest of Trump's term, at the very least, you'd hear a lot of bells going on around the country. Anyway, we do have to take our second break. We will be back after this with lots more news. Welcome back to the show, everybody. One more segment on our power panel for you, Angelo, Mark, and myself. I did not look at this. I'm going to try to do this really fast.
This is real time is what's happening. He's looking at these tweets in real time.
Yes. Okay, so I have some tweets for you. So Jack Reacher, wow, the real Jack Reacher, says, glad to see Angelo on. Want to thank him for Jeffrey Lord for being booted off of CNN. There you go. Let's see, the mathemagician says that leftist tuning, this is alluding to what you were talking about in the last segment, that leftist tuning out is terrifying when you consider that right-wing ecosystem is beginning to influence our education system.
Oh, that's a great point. We were just talking about that off the air, actually, that very thing.
Yeah, let's see. Okay, and then Bud Askins says Republicans are just jealous of Rep Wilson because they don't look as good in cowboy hats as she does.
She did rock a mean red cowboy hat.
You know, yeah, I tried, but it just doesn't work for me.
I think if we had a TYT cowboy hat, it's conceivable one day that it could show up on this power panel.
I bet, see, I can sort of say, from what I know of Cenk, there's a possibility he wouldn't want to wear it. He'd be a little bit, you know, like shy or whatever, but like, as soon as like nobody was watching, he he put it on. Because he wanted to know. Don't tweet that to him. Anyway, let's jump back into the news because we've got a pretty important story for you that I actually, to some extent, chose for you. So we'll see. You might be familiar with this, actually. There has been an absolutely titanic effort over the course of several decades now to get the public in the US, but around the globe, to care about climate change, to understand that it's going on and to understand what changes we might need to make socially and individually, but also in terms of government policy to do something about it. And it's been difficult. But now I wonder if along the way, the focus on climate change might have led people to pay a little bit less attention to some of the other things that are resulting from our emissions, other things that we're doing that aren't just starting to develop into disasters and will wreck our entire civilization in a few decades, but are doing terrible damage to us right now. And we've got some scary stats for you that we want to talk about. Now, this has to do with the effect of pollution. So not climate change off in the future, but pollution right now and how many people it kills around the globe. And this new study estimates that every year, it's killing 9 million people. And the belief is that that might actually be an underestimate. So the 9 million figure adds up to 16% of all deaths worldwide each year, killing 3 times more people than AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria combined. It's also, by the way, 15 times more deaths than wars and all other forms of violence.
Wow.
Now, when you think about what our government actually does to try to preserve your life, they focus on some of those a little bit more in terms of rhetoric, but also in terms of dollars. Now, if we can bring up this chart, you're going to see some of those contributors in terms of deaths. And you just see how much total pollution outpaces other things that are causing deaths. Now, things like tobacco smoking, that's tragic because it's entirely preventable. I mean, some of it's secondhand, but entirely preventable there. And you have things like disease, alcohol as well. And then you see down like war and murder, how low that is. And it just strikes me, and we'll return to the pollution in a second, but it strikes me at how bad we are as a species at understanding and prioritizing the things that are threats to our lives. And when you think about the fact that supposedly evolution is selecting based on your ability to identify risks and mitigate them. But when it comes to these big things, it's not the tiger in the bush, but it's the pollution in the air, it's the emissions from a power plant. We can't seem to understand that that is not comparable to terrorism, but that it blows terrorism out of the water in terms of the likelihood that you or someone you care about could be injured or die. And as a species, we just can't identify it, and so we don't prioritize it when it comes time to fund preventative measures.
You know, this is an amazing statistic. I'm so glad you show this. But you mentioned evolution. Let me just mention this from an evolutionary standpoint. There's a book called Sapiens, which I really recommend to people. And one of the things that's discussed in the book is the fact that as a people, I mean, as a species, we're able to conceptually group ourselves. And one of the things that's separated us from others, I mean, even other other sapiens at the beginning of time, was that we could create a concept that we could rally around, like all those people are bad, let's bind together and let's fight those people, or that thing is bad, maybe in this case pollution. So the idea that we have created a notion that murder and terrorism and the other things on that list are the real existential threat to us, whereas the thing on the top of the list that's an actual existential threat is not talked about much, which is this pollution. In fact, we just elected an administration that is committed to removing the protections, which are flimsy already, basic air and water protections. Mm-hmm. And so we're actually feeding this machine because we've sold the concept effectively. We've sold the concept to ourselves that the real threat to us is not this pollution. And pollution's bad, we all get that. But the real problem is the terrorists and the blowing up stuff and the shooting people. Yeah. That's all bad too. But this is happening on an ongoing basis. I think it's alarming to see the stat laid out like that. Is scary.
Yeah.
And I think it does dovetail with the corporate media too, right? Because this isn't just an ideological issue. In part, the reason that there's, say, an emphasis on hyping some of the threats because of the war machine, there's a profit piece there. And the reason you don't talk about some of the pollutants is partly because they are susceptible to being gamed by the both sides, but partly because it's bad business if you sort of, you know, make your advertisers angry.
Yeah.
And if they happen to be the industries that are putting a lot of money there, you don't really make it a thing. And that's sort of a testament to how we need media to hold these forces accountable, not just political, but otherwise, and what happens when they don't.
Yeah, and I agree. And look, in my intro, I talked about how we're thankfully focusing a little bit on climate change right now. Now, thankfully, a lot of the things that we should do and must do to mitigate the worst effects of climate change going forward would actually help significantly with pollution. And so you alluded to the corporate media. I think until we get money out of politics, get money out of the media in this way, let's at least utilize the corruption. So the people who are making the solar panels, could you please start advertising on CNN? Please. And then the government, let's just throw for the next 10, 20 years, let's throw billions in subsidies to people making solar cells. If you're going to sell out and if you're going to give all of our money to corporations, at least have it be the ones that are trying to save our lives, at the very least. But unfortunately, that's not what they're doing. And by the way, there's a quote from the study that says that the pollution is so dangerous that they say, quote, it threatens the continuing survival of human societies. And you will see these articles, CNN will have something on it. They're not gonna talk about it on the shows, but they'll have an article on the website and Think Progress is gonna cover it a lot, and that's going to be great, it's gonna be awesome. But like today, when you look at what was actually in the news, One America News Network took the new stats about crime in the UK, lied that they had something to do with radical Islamic terrorism, which led to a word for word tweet from Donald Trump of one of their chyrons.
Yep.
When it says nothing about radical terrorism, here they're saying it's a threat to the continuing survival of our species, and we'll talk about it, and then we'll move on. And look, a little bit more information for you. Although they say that no country is free of the damaging effects of pollution in the present day, 92% of the deaths that we were talking about occur in low and middle income countries. And so it's not, there's no equality in terms of this. It's disproportionately affecting people who have less of an ability to mitigate it.
But that's the high ground intellectually that everybody's clinging to, or emotionally clinging to. It's like, oh yeah, I know it's bad, Johnny, but if that's over there in the places where people don't have a lot of money and it's sort of let's be honest,
then
that's third world.
Them.
No, of course. And I would also say this, it's also happening here. In this country, first world, the problems of air and water pollution are being lived out right here in this place with all the money. So if you look at the statistical breakdown, they'll even show you deaths from those diseases that you're talking about, emphysema and the like, happening here in the US.
Yeah.
So when you look beyond the headlines, the percentages, I know they're lower, but it is happening here. People are losing their lives here because of that pollution.
Exactly. Yeah, and when you or someone you know has to go to the hospital and go into bankruptcy to deal with some of these sorts of diseases, understand that every dollar you put into that medical care is subsidizing the corporations that put the emissions and pollution into the air in the first place. That money is still being spent. It's just not being spent by the corporation. It's being spent by you and me, unfortunately. And let's bring up this one more graphic just to show you a distribution of some of the things that are leading to these deaths. I want you to understand that they come in multiple forms. This is a graphic 8. Obviously, airborne pollution is significant. Cars and industrial activity. Also, by the way, look into shipping. It's not talked about much, but it contributes so much emissions to the air. But also toxic water, something we talk about constantly on this network. Workplace pollution, but even things like heating systems and things like that in the third world are very significant. And by the way, and this is gonna continue on with my let's use the corruption thing. If people aren't going to care in this country and in this government about this problem just based on wanting to save their own lives, if that's not a significant enough driver of interest, well then let's bring up this graphic. Pollution related deaths resulted in a 6% hit to global GDP, a loss of $4.6 trillion each year. So like even if you don't mind that it's killing you, think about the money you could make if you were to deal with this. And by the way, as we said, all of these numbers are more than likely an underestimate of the actual effect, because many of the diseases that lead to several of the top 10 killers in America, things like diabetes and things like that, could have strong ties to pollution. They just don't know for sure yet, and so they're not included in these figures.
I posted a link to an article about this Trump-Pence administration and the relaxing of those protections of the EPA and Alzheimer's disease and the rise in Alzheimer's from pollution. All right, so from the very thing that we're talking about. So the health effects reverberate beyond the fatalities to diminish the kind of life you'll have in this country because of, look, this is the stuff happening now. This new administration is really destroying the environment. So I'm so glad you did that story.
Yeah. Thank you. I wish we had more time. I don't want to blow over to the second hour, so I'm going to give you, we don't do this. I'm going to give you a little bit of homework. I want you to Google Dickinson, Texas Hurricane Relief Israel and find out what's going on there, because it is a mind-blowing story. Maybe we'll be able to return to it next week. But anyway, I want to thank both of you for joining me. Visit Media Matters, understand and get a little bit of a taste of their new mission under this new social media-led media machine that they're working to help to counter. And Where can they see the show?
Come check out the podcast, I guess, The Edge with Mark Thompson, edge-show.com. But it's also iTunes and all the places that you hear podcasts. And got to get Angela on, because he'd be a great.
There you go.
Thank you.
I learned awesome. A lot today. So thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah,
thank
actually, you. So you said you had follow-ups. I have a lot of follow-ups, too. I feel like I know a lot about, you know, like the 4chan machine and all that, but you mentioned multiple groups that I'd never heard of before. So I'm going to have some follow-up questions for you, too. Anyway, thank you to both of you for joining me. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll have the second hour for you.